Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
So, Guy, Nick Mason, Sourceful of Secrets, of which we are two-fifths, right? We're going back out on the road in the summer across the UK.
We are. It's all of June, so brace yourself.
What's it called?
It's called the Set the Controls Tour. What a brilliant name. Who do you think could have come up with such a great name for a tour, Gary?
I wonder. I think I'm looking at him, right? But then I did come up with Nick Mason, Sourceful of Secrets.
You did, and in fact, that came up in a podcast then because you were inspired by Woody Woodman's U-Boat, weren't you?
I was, yes.
Anyway, but enough of that.
So, join Nick, Guy, Lee Harris, Don Beacon, and me as we celebrate the early years with, you know, that incredible, it's an incredible body of work, isn't it? The early Pink Floyd. It goes up to just before Dark Side of the Moon.
Goes up to 1972, with all the film soundtracks, all the Sid stuff, stuff you've never heard, stuff that no one's ever
heard,
frankly.
Obviously.
Echoes is the big sort of, you know, what is that? What would you call it?
Magnum opus.
Yeah, I love a Magnum, don't you?
Yeah, I never met Magnum. Anyway, tickets are on sale now and you can buy yours at myticket.co.uk.
And Kilimanjaro Live presents Nick Mason's Sourceful of Secrets, the Set the Control Tour.
Do you want even more Rock On Tours? Well, if so, go to rockontours.com and sign up for our new premium service, Rock On Tours Extra, where you can get access to bonus content, extra episodes, video, meet and greets, and even tickets to some very special events we have planned. It's something very special that we'll be announcing very soon with exclusive early access only to Rock On Tours subscribers. So head to rockontours.com to find out more.
Hello, Gary.
Hello, Guy.
It feels weird saying that, actually. It's saying that face to face to you.
Face to face. And we're both wearing blue.
We are both wearing blue.
We didn't get an email about that, did we?
No, and both wearing knitted cotton.
Right, so we've got merchandise sorted out for the future.
I'm sure. So anyway, this is a second part two.
Yes, it is. It is. It's not going to be a standard Rock On Tour, so we're not going to be going back through the whole career like we did before, but we are going back into the past, nevertheless.
Because, well, we're very much going back into the past. Well, because, let's face it, that's what we do.
Yeah, and he started it because he's come up with these diaries.
Yeah, he started it. I'm going to tell him that. He has come up with these diaries, which are fantastic. And it's also the fact that it is just those, it's that journey, that incremental journey from kind of nothing to everything, that's like the always the interesting bit of a band.
Yeah.
As he says himself, you know, it just kind of gets repetitive after that once you get.
Yeah, but when you look back on those diaries, there's a sort of, you know, that innocence of not knowing that he was going to become one of the biggest rock stars in the world. You know, that's quite touching in a way. Did you ever have that moment? Do you have diaries?
I don't have diaries. I found one from 1987, but it was literally just kind of Psalm 12 o'clock.
Yeah, well, not far off.
Well, I guess it's not that. Yeah.
Laundry?
Did you? I bet you did, but yours were with press flowers.
You know what?
And everything.
I do. There are periods when I kept diaries. Yeah, but it tends to be January when they're really intense and all about my inner emotions, and then by February I'm bored.
Yeah,
you know, it's back to laundry. You know.
I did used to keep journals when I went on adventurous trips, like going around Peru or something. I would keep a journal, which is a very Victorian gentleman sort of thing.
You came back from Peru with some Peruvian costume, didn't you, or something? Which you was. What did they wear in Peru? They wear.
I can't remember. I thought I just borrowed an old one of yours.
And you said I'm definitely going to be wearing this when I get the milk in the mornings in Notting Hill Gate. Because some things don't travel, do they?
No. So much doesn't travel, as I think everyone has found out over the years. Things to remember whenever you see anything when you're on holiday is context is all.
It is, yeah. Listen, I wanted to just mention Harry Belafonte.
Yes.
Died. Did you know Calypso was the first million-selling album?
That's right, I did know that.
Ever. And when I grew up as a kid, you know, Deo was
how
like everywhere.
Well, I was going to say, how well do you remember that? It's literally, it's imprinted in your DNA like Oliver is.
It is. And the Jamaica song. And I think there might be a connection with Stewart.
They're just honest.
Can I also ask you a question? Do you know what the first million-selling single ever was?
Is it Heartbreak Hotel?
No, it's before then.
Is it White Christmas?
Well, that was one of them, but not the first. Chattanooga Choo Choo.
Oh.
Glenn Miller. Which my son loves. He's playing that all the time. And then there was another one, and this was also on the radio, non-stop when we were kids. 16 Tons.
Oh, so, and what do you get?
Yeah. So actually, funny enough, Deo and 16 Tons, two songs about workers.
Yeah, yeah.
One about people loading up a banana boat and the other one about a miner.
Yeah, you know? It's very true. Yeah, it was kind of years before Springsteen.
Who recorded 16 Tons?
Johnny Cash.
He must have done, but it wasn't the hit single.
I thought you were about to.
I am going to tell you, and it's.
Come on, Bill.
It's. Oh my God, it's a guy called Ford. He's called. We're going to look him up, right? We're going to look him up while the music runs or whatever that thing when we have the intro tape, as it were. We're going to look him up, and I'm going to tell you who it was because it's a bizarre one.
Well, let's get Stewart on.
Welcome to the Rock and Toast.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
That's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
That caused a big problem in the band, actually. I was having too much fun.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it, and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Well, I get the feeling that us three should go for a pint. That's what I think.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock on Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
My rightful place at the center of things.
At the center of a three-piece.
Yeah, right. That's right. Use that to see the back of your head.
Let's get going. Keep it rolling. Keep it rolling.
My particular three-piece was my favorite angle.
Keep it rolling. Yeah. Roll it up.
We're giving you pearls here.
Yes.
I've just realized we've got a power trio right here.
We shall talk like the wind.
So, yeah, it's a trick. I've actually brought the peroxide along, so I thought that we can just all
you
do
can
it,
both
right?
Use a bit of peroxide,
I'd say. Desperately looking online for your 1978.
Although, just give
Ridley's
it a couple
commercial.
More years and you won't need any peroxide, I think, there, guy.
Oh, it started.
Yeah.
We were having a discussion. Sorry, were you just about to say something?
I was
about
just
peroxide,
about to say something.
So sorry.
No, I was just saying that I've been talking of the peroxide. I've been desperately looking online. You can't find, I don't know if it's been scrubbed, your 1978 Wrigley's commercial.
No, it doesn't exist. Because commercials, as we all know, are they hire 10 different people to do it, and the winner goes on the air. And they spend a lot of money on other versions, and this was a lost other version. The client, Wrigley's, just, I don't know. And so it went into a vault never to be seen again.
Oh, wow.
Many have tried to find it.
I'm sure that Miles didn't have something to do with that, making sure it stayed in the vault.
It's buried, isn't it?
Who?
Miles buried it.
Although I did Miles wouldn't have buried it. Miles would have put it out there. I think Doris Sting would have, for some reason, he was ouchy about that.
Well, there's still the one, you can see a nanosecond of him in the Triumph bra commercial.
Oh, great. Has that been found? Hopefully that has been
found.
What
happened? What is that about?
Could you send me that one? I'd like to have that in my collection.
It's on YouTube. It was when I typed in Police 1978 Ringers
commercial.
Well,
that guy.
Came up with the Triumph.
Did you do the bra commercial? Is that what you did?
Nobody was interested in my bra commercial.
Sting was the only person who looked good in one.
That's right. But his wife was an actress, and her agent, Pippa Markham, took one look at the husband and said, well, let's send him to the audition for the modeling, for anything. And he would show up for something and get the gig because, you know, that golden ray of light coming from the heavens descending upon his magnificent brow.
Well, it's what you saw as well, isn't it? Fair enough. Yeah. It's what you saw. That's what I saw.
When I first saw him, there it was, shaft, light. And besides, he could sing and play bass and had a cool-looking amp.
What is it?
What is it?
What was the charisma? What could you bottle that? Could you put a?
I can remember it distinctly as just being meal ticket.
Is it confidence? Do you think it's the confidence that
swagger?
Has?
Yeah, there's a swagger to it. And even though when we were playing punk music, you know, the first year and a half, it was all my crap songs. You know, my two chords and crap.
That's right. That's the
bass line with yelling.
Yeah.
And he hadn't started to write yet, and yet we stuck together.
You mean Clown's Revenge couldn't have got to it?
I played
Every Breath You Take level.
Clown's Revenge was one of the songs I played him when he came down to London. I talked to him on the phone, and he came down to London, came over, and I like played him. This is the material we got. I got this band. I hadn't yet found a guitarist, which meant that I got me, and I'm planning to find a guitarist. But since you can play bass and sing, that takes care of that. Any old guitarist who can play three chords is fine.
Yeah, yeah.
But he heard my demos, which I've listened to recently, and not incredibly impressive. I think it was the Fast Talk.
Yeah, yeah. Listen, I just wanted to, before we get properly into the Police and everything, and we were just having a discussion on our intro about, well, we mentioned Harry Belafonte, obviously. And we mentioned
Police, Harry Belafonte?
Yeah, no. Yeah, well, he, you know, having just died, we mentioned that he was the first million-selling album, Calypso. Mm. And then there was a bit of a discussion about the first million-selling songs. And the first one, do you know?
No, I don't.
Glenn Miller.
Good for him. String of Pearls, Chattanooga Choo Choo, of course.
And then the other one was 16 Tons.
16 Tons and a da da da.
But I couldn't remember.
Well, you guys can both sing.
Who recorded it?
No idea.
Tennessee Ernie Ford.
Well, even if I had known that, I wouldn't have remembered it.
But exactly.
Even if I'd remembered it, I wouldn't have known that name.
To be fair, that was a Google discovery.
Yeah, well,
okay. He did have Ford.
The beginning of pop music. This was the beginning, wasn't it?
I thought it was Fats Domino. Well, it was the first like recorded backbeat. And I can't remember what the song was, but my research turned up Fats Domino recording in New Orleans was the first rock riff.
That's, oh, really? No, that's probably
can
true.
Can we borrow your researcher?
that's probably true.
And also, the other link, of course, the Police played the Banana Boat song, apparently.
Well, no, Sting would, because of his background on playing the cruise ships, which is where he learned his craft, by the way. You know, a lot of times, stern employment. No,
hang on, I didn't know that.
What craft was it, exactly?
Songwriting.
The cruise ship.
Cruising.
Exactly.
No, how songs are constructed. Verse, chorus.
Yeah,
verse,
I thought you meant sea craft. Sorry.
Yeah, right. No, he was forced to learn the hit. And, you know, this is my thesis, is that sometimes, you know, I was a film composer for 20 years. Yeah. Before the master, hired gun, flinty-eyed. You want happy, I'll give you happy. You want sad, I'll give you... You want happy, sad, I can do that. That's not an artist, that's a craftsman. And as a craftsman, you have to go places that you would never go as an artiste. You know, one thing for me was when the director turns around, Francis Coppola turns around, we need strings. Fine. And so began a lifelong adventure with orchestra, which came out of stern employment. And so for Stingo, playing the hits on a cruise ship taught him, because he was a jazz guy, he had no interest in that music at all, but it taught him the construction of a pop song, pieces are. And it kind of went into his thing, and he never would have dreamed of dredging it out until the wheel turned and Prague was out and short, pungent songs were in. And I think that stern employment from his past stood us all well.
I think the thing that's fascinating about Sting's songs, and it probably comes from that, and it's a level of, I mean, listen, I think he's one of the greatest songwriters of all time. We all know that.
You want to see my car?
There's always a level of storytelling that is not personal. You know, he's not really, it's putting himself in another persona, in another character. Usually dark.
Well, there is some darkness there. There is pain in that heart. He is the king of that stuff, by the way.
King of pain.
Yeah, and I think that's where it comes from. That I'm just a loosey, goofy guy. I bang stuff, you know. I just, you know, sure, I can bang away on a riff, but to create those lyrics needs a deeper perspective on life. And like, as you very cleverly notice, he dodges the bullet. It's not about me. It's not I love you. It's someone else loves someone. And he presents it in a way that everyone can identify with, but he kind of, you know, every breath you take is someone else being a voyeur, even though it's in first person singular.
Yeah.
But yeah, he sort of...
I always thought that was him.
You did.
Punk was always, I don't want to do this. I don't want to do that.
It was negative, so that's the whole thing.
I actually do know who and what that was about, and it wasn't him.
No.
And I tell him.
Oh.
We're good chuckle buddies here, but there's a camera rolling. Well, I mean, I can tell you that it's his favorite feature of the song. Not only that it's the biggest selling single ever, the most airplay, radio played song ever, when you combine the Police version and the Puff Daddy version. His favorite thing, apart from that, is that people tell him that they play it at their weddings. And it's like, but really? Have you actually listened to the lyric? But he loves that fact. And many of his songs actually have a hidden meaning. I think they're about this, because I only, you know, like I say, I'm only looking at the back of his head. I'm not sure what he's singing about. But many of the times I've thought the song was about this, but actually it's about that.
But here's the thing, but the reason that that songwriting got to take flight was this, one thing that comes over from the bit of the diaries we've seen is that it was you putting your foot down about punk. About
yes.
It being punk.
I was the punk Ayatollah. I was the Taliban of punk in the group. And they all, in their autobiography since, they all talk about, well, Stuart was just on this mission. He was foaming at the mouth with this whole punk thing. True. But that was our meal ticket. There were no other gigs. There was no other scene. There was, you know, we weren't going to get airplay.
And it was early, but it was early. You were hip to it.
Yeah, 76. And through 77, and we starred through all those years until Andy joined. And for some reason, Sting and I stuck together in spite of, you know, we were very codependent in those days. We had a rhythm section. We knew that we rocked, and we got a lot of gigs as session players. And but we just soldiered on in spite of being spotted by the critics as carpetbaggers.
Yeah, well, when you say carpetbaggers, I mean, I like the Sting came down from Newcastle. You know, it's the same journey that Bruce Welch and Hank Marvin.
Sounds like something from a folk song.
Yeah.
Sting came down from Newcastle.
Hi-ho. Yeah, not as good as the one Sting would write, though.
No.
But, you know, it's almost like, you know, that journey down to London was so important in those days. It's not anymore. You know, people can make music everywhere, but London was the center of everything, wasn't it?
I thought he came because I called him and summoned him, and he came to my door. No, he came down.
He wasn't part
anyway.
Of the Jarrow March.
No, he came down anyway. He came down
barefoot.
Yeah,
but there's a great bit in the diary where you talk about that first moment he comes into your room where the drum kit is.
Yeah. And we just blaze. And he wrote the same thing in his diary, that moment was like, damn, this is the musician I've been waiting for. And we just went off into places. And we eventually did kind of grow in different directions. And, you know, we were not so codependent anymore. But when we first started out, all we had was each other. And no songs, no Roxanne, no Message in a Bottle, no Every Breath You Take. He hadn't started writing them yet.
So what were you playing?
When
you
were saying that,
we were playing Clown's Revenge
songs, but was he not writing music at all?
He had a couple of retreads from his
bass instrumental, like sort of Autumn Leaves, or kind of.
No, he had some retreads that he sped up from his jazz band and his Newcastle jazz band, Last Exit. And there were a few, but they weren't the ones that you remember now. They were sort of in that ilk, two chords, because our guitarist could only play three chords, which I showed him. Once again, that plus the cruise ships, plus being forced into this distilled, no song longer than 2.5 minutes, straitjacket, kept him kind of bottled up, but we were a great rhythm section. We just fit together with cool grooves, and we got a lot of work. And one of the sessions that we showed up for, the guitarist walks in, triple scale legendary guitarist who probably cost the boss more than us two put together, but times 10, walks in, name of Andy Summers. And we play this kind of prog material. Mike Hallett was the boss. And
How you came up the other week?
Well, it was his solo album. For some reason he wanted two basses. Go figure.
I see.
Go figure. Two basses, you'd like that.
I've tried it. I was in a band with youth with two basses. It's a disaster.
It's the
worst idea ever.
But as we're driving home, and we're going places that we never allowed ourselves to go with the Police because we were a punk rock band.
So the three of you were
just Sting and I. Yes, the three of us, including Andy, who we just met that day.
Yeah, it's out there?
20 years later, I get a call from Mike Hallett saying, remember that album that we recorded? Do you mind if I release it? I said, dude, you paid me 20 quid. It's your record. What he was really asking about, can I use the word Police in the title?
Right, so he released it,
Police Academy. And that's exactly what it is. You can hear that rhythm section, and Andy, you can hear the Police, but we're playing nothing like the music we were playing at the time. It was prog with lots of drum fills.
And are you feeling unleashed? Is it
unleashed? Exactly. And so driving home that night, you know, Sting is seething. You know, his musicality is just rising up. I understand that this is our mission and everything, but God, don't just a couple notes of music, please. Oh Lord, let me. Can we get that guy? Come on, Stuart, get that guy. And we can't afford him. I could indulge his fantasy.
Why was he expensive? What was the?
Well, he was.
Andy was a
triple scale top jobbing.
Because he's older than you guys.
He was doing things 10 years like John Lord solo stuff. He was doing all sorts of.
Neil
is Andy 80 now?
Savoy Brown.
Yeah, all kinds of stuff. Yeah. Animals.
He was older. He's a 60s player.
That's right.
Isn't he? Yeah.
That's right. And he'd been around the block. He had a huge musical education.
There's no question that Andy's style must have influenced Sting's songwriting.
It wouldn't have happened. I'd have lost him, for one thing. So we're driving home, and he's seething, and I'm kind of humoring him, because I know we can't afford it. It's not going to happen. But we did play a show with Mike Howlett in Paris, and we played a show at the Marquee, and Andy jumped on the stage, and we were kind of circling, and could he's not. You know. Finally, one day, Andy popped the question. He was talking to Sting and said, let's do it. And I ran into him that same afternoon at Oxford Street Tube Station.
Hence one train later.
And he pulls me into a caff and he says, dude, you and that bass player, he didn't use the word dude, whatever the 70s version of dude was.
Squire.
Dear boy.
Squire.
Dear boy, yeah.
Geezer.
You and that bass player have got something, but you need me in the band and I accept. Now, Andy objects fiercely when I tell this story, but it's so Andy, and it's so who he is. He's direct, straight to the point. That's his thing, and that which I admire. And I'm going, dear boy, we don't have a record company. I'm the record company. Illegal Records is just me with a letra set. We don't have management. And we don't have any roadies either. Yeah, we do. You. And I was just, because I knew that, you know, this is great and everything, but he's not gonna last. And years later, recently, I asked him, now I can use the word dude.
Dude,
what were you thinking? Joining a couple of fake punks, scorned by all, although he probably didn't know that, of a punk band going nowhere with no Roxanne, no Message in a Bottle, no material apart from Clown's Revenge. What were you thinking? And he says, I don't know, mate, should have stuck with Neil Sedaka. You know.
Brilliant. Because that first time he played, he just got up for an encore or something, didn't he?
Yeah, he got up.
I love that, you know, and it's.
I've got the recording, by the way.
No one younger would understand how seismic this is, because it seems such a ridiculous detail. But is that he was wearing flares.
Yes, he cut it. Well,
it's like, oh my God.
I don't understand why you wanted him in the band then. Because honestly, because you're already kind of trying to sneak under the radar.
We were already written off, and we just wanted to play some music. We just wanted to do some interesting stuff. And Henry, bless his heart, he could play those guitar licks really forcefully. He had a great presence on stage, but just, oh Lord, could we just play some music for a living?
But what would it be that would qualify you to play punk gigs? What element did you have to add? Were you insistent on
A desire to do so, and a spotting of the fact. That was it. You know, there was this party we threw. We were in a squat in Mayfair at the time. It was a very fancy flat that we were squatting in. It full of, you know, bohemian grandeur with chandeliers and wood paneling and exotica climbing up the walls. And, you know, it's pretty fancy. So when Sting came over, he went, wow, this looks pretty high. He was fooled by the fact that I didn't tell him right away that we were squatting.
Right. He thought it was yours.
And anyway, our friend who is Luke O'Reilly, who was managing Al Stewart.
Oh, yeah.
Throws a party for his client at our splendiferous flat. Meanwhile, I'm up in Sheffield playing with Curved Air, and we drive down, or whatever city, we drive down that night. And as we arrive in silent, quiet Mayfair, and we could hear the party from blocks away. And we can hear it's coming from that's our apartment. My brother Ian knew how to throw a party. Mm-hmm. He was the expert DJ. He just could read the room and had a personality out to hear. And so we get up there and it's blazing. What is that music? And we get in there and it turns out that some of the youngsters who were there were Steve Cook or Paul Cook and Steve Jones and Glenn Matlock. I didn't identify them yet at the time. But there were these kids there.
You knew Jonesy had been there when some stuff went missing.
Yeah, and there was a hat, and I looked out the window. I saw him walking off, you know, wearing the hat. Hey, you! but this wild party was going, and all the Al Stewart glamorati in their bell bottoms and sophistication, and they would have been dancing suavely like that until these kids showed up with their own records and start putting them on, and Ian could see the room light. Yeah, a lot more of that. What else you got? And see, and they're out there just burning everything down. Well, and so when by the time I got there, the party was in raging swing with two camps. So sort of the sophistos were kind of off in the corner disapproving and saying, that's not music, but, you know. And these young kids, who I don't even know if they were called punks yet, look hadn't quite, but they were just
It's not the year of the cat anymore.
No. It was the Blank Generation, I think, was by Richard Hell. That was the main tune of the night.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that explosion there with my brother Ian, who is an agent also, and me and Miles as well, spotted that's the next big thing. That's what's happening, because we were all aware there was the crash of vinyl prices and explosion of vinyl prices, crash of the music industry, and everything came tumbling down. But that scene was thriving, kicking, and you could do it yourself. You didn't need to go to the man. You didn't need to go to the record company. It was like a self-starting scene, and that just looks really cool. So that was when we spotted, okay, the Copeland family is getting into this business.
You wanted to mention the squat.
I was about this flat, because when you say it was a squat, that's not strictly true, is it?
Well, we were squatting. That's true. Well,
that's come from his wannabe a punk era.
Well, okay.
Yeah, I've met quite a few people in my time who lived in squats that sort of...
My father had a friend.
The trust owned.
Yeah. But it was some socialite friend of your dad's.
That's right. Who wanted to get rid of her other lodgers, so nothing stopping her from inviting a few more. So.
And as the book suggests, I did Google Lady Georgina Campbell.
That's a story.
Wow.
That's a story.
Tell us more. Who's going to tell us the intimate details?
Go ahead.
She was, I can't remember where she was born, but she was born with some weird fused genitals, and so was raised as a boy, and then this caused a great, I can't remember all the history, but she became a lady because she was married to someone for like 15 days or something.
Yeah, that got her a title.
Yeah, got her title, and then ended up, and then she was the one person who you just couldn't.
All the rest, they took a look at us and left, and I was there with my brother Ian and Sonia Christina, and we moved in, and we threw these wild parties, and she could not shake her. In fact, after, you know, particularly wild, noisy parties, Ian would wake up and his hangover, and like, and he would see a nice glass of water with an aspirin that she had left for him. Take that, motherfucker. You know, right. Who's going to win this test of wills? But we did suspect that Sonia was being secretly nice to her, because she's like that.
Sisterhood.
Yeah.
Right.
But eventually she did leave. And when the room she moved out of, I moved in all my drums and my gear and the PA and the amps, and that's where the police rehearsed. And that's where we began, is in that squat.
That is amazing, because I remember when I was a kid that time, there were, it was just possible you knew people who just ended up in amazing parts of London, in amazing flats, for sort of weird, nothing to do with money or anything.
Just knew somebody for some reason.
That's just when I first met Steve Strange. You know, he was living in some rich French guy's house in Chelsea with Oliver Tobias.
Yeah.
You know, so I suddenly, you know, I found myself walking into interiors that I could, you know, I'd never even imagined existed. I spent the rest of my life trying to recreate.
Remember that Steve Strange pad.
And also, I just wanted to also, there was something in the diary that that rung a bell as well, because after you have this moment with Sting and there's just the two of you and you're jamming on your first moment together, you go off and see Generation X at the
Roxy that night.
I was at that gig. Well, I was in that room.
And Billy Idol killed it. I mean,
well, this is it, because that's the thing.
He couldn't sing worth a darn.
Yes, but
Billy, he just had that. He had also a golden ray of.
But I think that Sting must have. You're playing with Sting, and you guys have got something going. Then you go to see that gig, and you've got, I thought at the time, and proven right, this great peroxide pop star.
Yeah,
was burgeoning. He was at the Roxy.
Ah.
You know, just
Gary, so, are you suggesting the peroxide?
Well, I'm suggesting the whole thing that Sting, who is a jazzer, goes along to see Generation X and Billy Idol, and he goes, maybe this is right. This is what I should be doing. I can do that.
Well, it wasn't out of admiration, but yes, he did have that exact epiphany, but it wasn't, wow, that's so great, I want to do that.
Right, no, yeah, it was, like, that'll work.
Yeah. I could do that in a heartbeat. Yeah. Man. Look at all these kids around. Look at all these minnows around here. Let's eat them all. And that was pretty much our attitude.
And he's handsome, my God. They were both handsome. Yeah, and handsome gets you in rooms and in the charts.
Yeah.
When you look back in, when you were looking back in those diaries, and were there surprises for you? Has this been, because the last time we spoke to you, you hadn't even dug these out, you know? And were there epiphanies for you?
The main one was how hard we worked. And the days begin. Wake up, drive over to Putney, pick up the gear, go pick up Sting, drive up to St. John's Wood to get my drums, drive down to Mano's rehearsal to rehearse for 4 hours, drop the gear back over at so-and-so's place, pick up the PA, go down to the NME to hustle for some ink. Mission after mission, crisscrossing London every day. And then down to the Vortex to see, you know... the Vibrators.
Yeah, yeah.
And then after that, over to the 100 Club to see someone else. And then, you know, the pace of it and the struggle of it. And the thing that makes the struggle so poignant is that we didn't have those songs yet. What was it that stuck us together? Because, of course, you can imagine everybody was whispering in Stingo's ear, hey.
So what was your set list?
The set list, it's in the book, actually.
Mother?
Not Mother. No, we hadn't yet reached that elevated state of musicality. Clown's Revenge, Landlord. They're all crap songs that I wrote, just utilitarian. You know, here's E-E-A-A-D-D-D-E. Okay, let's start with D this time. D-D-A-A, you know, just riffs with yelling. And he started by replacing some of the lyrics and writing some lyrics. I think Dead End Job might have been his. No, Landlord. He took my bass line and came up with a different lyric.
Not Landlord's Revenge.
Yeah, Landlord's Revenge. And then not too impressive catalog of material, but sort of interesting to look back on now. And I've got these recordings of our first rehearsals with Sting on the mic and singing some songs that later became Clark Kent songs. I'm particularly proud of those recordings.
People get precious about who's the songwriter in the band. Hello, did I say that?
Should we recut that with me saying that, Gary?
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean. Yeah, I mean, listen.
Can the non-major songwriters have a little moment here?
Even now, in Pink Floyd and people, everyone's trying to claim that song and who was really at the heart of it. And was there for you, though, that sort of like fear that this guy's going to come along and I'm not going to be the songwriter?
No, not at all. I'm a younger sibling, happy to be just on the team. I wrote these songs so that we'd have something to play. And so that I could tell them, yeah, we got material. And I played them these crap demos that I made myself on guitar and stuff. And that didn't send him running, which is another miracle. And so I think the first one he brought was Visions of the Night. Not one of the big Police songs that anyone remembers, but it was a total upgrade. Wow, let's play that. And then
he came up with... doesn't scream punk, though, does
no,
it?
No. He had another one which had some
I don't
airy
want
fairy
Visions
title.
Of the Night. Yeah.
Well, he had some other song with an airy fairy title, which was a retread from his jazz band. And said, that's no, we're going to call it 3 o'clock shit. And he said, okay. But then he would mumble the lyrics so that nobody would know he was deep. But one by one, his songs would come in, and each time, that was the best song on our list. And I never noticed that as these songs would arrive, that song would depart. I didn't care. All I wanted was us to have fantastic material to play, and he delivered. It wasn't until we actually made the album and were doing the credits, that was the first time I even noticed. But even then, it didn't really, wasn't a big deal.
Yeah, no, I feel that Andy's has this extraordinary guitar playing, doesn't he? I mean, this arpeggiation
the guy who put nines into rock music.
He really did, actually, even though it's the 70s, he set the sound for the 80s, didn't he?
Yeah, well, with his soundscape. It wasn't just it was a warrior.
That was the thing that the Police had. It was that I loved. I mean, I kind of forget first time hearing Walking on the Moon. It was just this hugeness.
Massive compression.
Yeah. But there's the most overused cliche in all of music is that thing of it's not what you play, it's what you don't play. But the Police are actually the only real living example
we
of
used
that
to say
working,
all the time, less is more.
You don't play the one.
Huh?
You didn't play the one.
Who needs one when there's a perfectly good three coming right up?
Exactly.
That's right.
Just hold it. Two, three, four.
It's just
two,
like buses.
Three,
you wait
four.
For one and then three come along all at once.
There you go. Yeah.
Was there a moment when you look back in these diaries and you can sense, oh, we were going to give up then?
Well, Mike Howlett called with Andy Summers, and he had the band that we were supposedly being was Strontium 90, which I thought was kind of a cool name.
That was a very cool name, by the way.
And he changed it to The Elevators. Not a great name.
You're up against, yeah, the Manchester lot, which is Mick Hucknall's band, was Frantic Elevators.
Oh, okay, much better name. But I thought that I'm going to lose my band and we're all going to become part of Mike's band. That was the closest we ever came because of the magnet of Andy. Fortunately, Andy made his choice and decided to go with the two fake punk rockers rather than prog Mike, who had quite good material. But Andy just saw these guys.
He then went on to be Mr. 80s Pop anyway, didn't he? Flock of Seagulls. And we were talking about him a couple of weeks ago. Who is it he'd produced?
Yeah, I can't remember. Our listeners will know. Let us know rudely.
Oh, God, no.
Yeah, they'll be on the mail.
Yeah, Twitter abuse.
Fortunately, Andy chose, I discovered Sting and Andy discovered us. And fortunately, that was one of the times. Billy Ocean offered him a gig for £50 a week. Which is big money in those days.
Yeah.
But I guess what was so good about The Police and why it worked in the end, and the cream rose to the top, didn't it? You know, of punk. But is you were a little bit older and you still had one toe in actual musical past.
Yes.
That everyone was trying to say was full of dinosaurs and didn't, mean
boring
it.
Boring old farts.
It's actually interesting that because look at us. We all went through punk. I remember taking my records and selling a lot of them, and then having to buy them back, and then
serves you right.
And then people were saying, punk is for the people, and it's about the kids and the trouble is
invented
the past.
By Vivian Westwood.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, a designer.
Well, exactly.
It's
an
extremely expensive uniform you can buy on King's Road.
Yeah, absolutely. But it was young people making prog. It wasn't old people making prog.
Was making something. And as far as behind the actual music, behind the actual style, was the do-it-yourself vibe of it. We didn't need to go to Decca, which was Curved Air's record company, and ask for a favor to put us into a studio. You could do it all yourself. I borrowed 400 quid from a friend, Paul Mulligan. We went to Pathway Studios.
That's where we went, yeah.
Yeah, Pathway. And where The Damned and Elvis Costello.
Dire Straits.
Dire Straits, really.
Well, their first, they're Sultans of Swing. They recorded at Pathway, and then they tried to make it better in another studio later, and they couldn't. They put the demo
up. Is there a plaque? There needs to be a plaque.
No, it's not there anymore.
No, but a plaque.
On Pathway Studio should have a plaque.
Yeah, yeah. In Islington, wasn't it?
We went to Sigma Sound in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And our big pilgrimage, and it's a car park.
Yeah. That studio where all that stuff happened was about half the size of this room. Yeah,
it was.
And the control room was a broom closet. And yet so much great stuff came out of that room.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This episode of Rock on Tours is sponsored by AG1, the daily nutrition supplement.
AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other vital ingredients like gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, and much more.
Just one scoop of AG1 daily has all the nutrients you need to support your mental performance, energy levels, heart health, and immune system.
To be honest, it's pretty vital stuff for us, because when you've got a life on the road and you're short of time, or you're too busy to plan and prepare healthy meals, you're getting your podcast together, you're being shouted at, and it's just a nightmare, AG1 gives me all the good stuff and helps keep my energy levels where I need, ready for showtime or doing the podcast, and with a nice vanilla taste.
It keeps me focused, feeling good, feeling healthy with its daily dose of vitamin C and zinc. And it's so easy to use. Just one scoop a day gives me over 70 carefully selected ingredients. Simple.
Trusted by Olympians, F1 drivers and the Rock On Tours. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and a free 1 year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription.
Go to drinkag1.com/rockontours. That's drinkag1.com/rockontours. Check it out.
Were you with Sonia when you left?
The whole time, yeah.
And how did she feel about you leaving? Because obviously in the diaries there's stuff about...
Left what?
Left their band.
The Curved Air?
Yeah.
No, Curved Air just kind of fizzled out.
Oh, right.
And I don't even recall when it ended. Just there were no dates on the date sheet. We could feel the entropy of the whole prog world in general, and Curved Air specifically. We could just feel it just running out of gas. And then this new thing happened, and I was all into setting up this new band and the DIY aspect of it, which meant that I could just borrow some money from a friend. We record the record. I designed the record sleeve myself with Letraset. I don't know if any of you are listening. Yeah, they're all our age. They might remember Letraset.
Yeah, we all had Letraset.
And I had made the thing and misspelled it and then had to do it, you know. And it was complete. And then I would print the record. I took the tape and had it printed into 2,000 singles. And I learned later that if I had the singles printed first, deliver them to RCA, who's pressing the record, they will put the record into the sleeves. But I didn't do that. So we got 2,000 white sleeves, and Sting, Henry, and I, and Miles actually, was sitting at the Marlboro Place, pulling it out of the white sleeve, putting into a pitcher sleeve, pulling out of the white sleeve, putting into a pitcher sleeve.
So that was your Blue Monday, wasn't it? You know, when it ended up costing more than...
Yeah. Well, I ended up with these boxes of records, which I would sell using Miles's office, and get on the phone and sell to record stores in Birmingham, Leeds, whatever. And the conversation would go, well, is it punk? Yes. Has it got a picture sleeve? Yes. Is it hostile? Yes. Box of 25, please. Yeah. Wow. Easy peasy. Yeah. And because the record stores would say that, look, we've been selling records all this time, but we have a rack called, the kids would come and say, where's the punk? And they'd go over to the punk rack. They'd never heard any of the records because there's no airplay. They would look at the sleeves, say, yep, hostile, and buy it. And that's pretty much... We actually got royalties. You know, I'd never got royalties from Curved
Air.
That's
right. It had to look like a hostage letter, didn't
that's
it?
Right, yeah.
That's right. Well, it was Jamie Reed who came up with the hostage writing. But because it also, it's because like you say, because the thing is, because punk, no one had heard it. It just existed in the music papers. And it was really interesting what you were saying earlier about your crisscrossing town in your day involved going to the NME offices.
Oh,
and that's
absolutely.
The one thing, well, it's going to be the one form of media where, and every band will tell you this, you just went there. To get
those
in the paper, you went there, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, bastards. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. That's like getting Instagram to put your reel out on the front page.
On Longacre,
isn't it?
Down in Soho. Well, there was NME, Melody Maker, and Sounds, and I forget which office was
Danny
which.
Danny Baker on the front desk.
Yeah.
I think maybe that was a bit after that.
And the NME carved us up rotten. And years later, when we did our big reunion tour in 2007, and the world is at our feet, and we are now, hey, Mr. NME, I'll give you an interview. And fully intending to abuse the guy and do everything with a journalist you're not supposed to do, because I don't care. Problem was, NME declined. Bastards! 30 years later!
But what was your audience, though? Was it the same audience that went to the Vibrators gig?
Was mostly members of the other bands who were copping licks. Sparsely attended shows. Occasionally we would get a halfway decent review.
Paul Simonon turned up some point. And
I remember when we went down to play in France at the Mont-de-Marsan Festival, if I got the name right. Anyhow, this festival, all these London punk bands, including The Clash, were on the bus, and Paul Simonon, kind of without Joe catching it, was actually asking Sting about, you know, should the finger be like that or should it be horizontal? You know, he actually gave a shit about his instrument. He wanted to be a good musician.
Yeah. I'm wearing his watch. He gave me this watch.
Oh, I thought you were telling me to hurry up. Yeah. We're finished. The pub's open.
Well, some of those punk rock musicians, in spite of their stance, actually were kind of into music and wanted to be good. It wasn't just a pose. They actually really wanted to be good musicians.
Did you support any of the bands?
Oh, I supported them all.
Who?
Because we were the fakes and they were the real things.
So would you get bottled off?
Especially with your sort of chops. I was wondering what the thing is, like you're saying, about people caring about their music, wanting to be good. But like, what was the cutoff point? How good were you allowed to be? Do you know what I mean? Well, where did you have to put a lid on it?
We could not play...
Diminished.
I could play drum fills.
A minus seventh.
Well, good for Rat Scabies of the Damned, who was like the closest that era ever came to Keith Moon. Just constant, nonstop barrage. That meant it was okay for me to play plenty of drum tom-tom fills. Yeah. But what was not allowed was love songs, guitar solos, improvisation. The songs had to be on the money, slam, bam, thank you, ma'am. And all these things. Those are the things that we started to bend the rules on just because we lack
no
of discipline.
Flat.
But you know what? This is
the sorts of chords had to
be open. Yeah.
This is interesting in the evolution of pop music because that cleaned out all of the clutter of guitar solos and impro. And that's what the 80s were about. There were no guitar solos in the 80s, maybe a sax solo later on.
Well, I dispute that. I mean, actually, the 80s, certainly in America, in mainstream music, it was actually the age of the guitar solo. It was the age of the Steve Lukather and the Eddie Van Halen.
Yeah, the shredding.
Yeah but shredding, I mean, I'm just thinking, you know, when it was like Ultravox and Duran and Coltrane and Spano, you know, it was the song was everything, wasn't it? You know?
Well, it is ironic that the punk-a-rama came with burned down everything, and they burned away the guitar solo, they burned out the love songs, and we're left with E, A, and D chords through a Marshall amp with a drum set playing a backbeat. The fundamental back to the exact same ingredients that have been there since, you know,
Summertime
the Shadows.
Blues, basically.
You know?
Yeah. Summertime Blues, yeah.
And it was just went back to, it didn't go back to somewhere new, it went back to what was there before. In fact, ultra-traditional. I didn't mind, I love Marshall amps. And E, A, and D chords.
Well,
because even
before,
I can play them.
Yeah, but you've said before, I remember from years ago, I don't know if I mentioned this in the last interview, that you said the thing you liked about punk was that you liked Jimi Hendrix and no one else seemed to be into that at the time. Everyone wanted to be mellow.
Yes, at the time of the prog rock, I was into blazing, burning down the building, but everyone else was into intellect. And they had this horrible thing that producers would tell me about. You want to? It would come in to produce Curved Air and ruin the band. Fatback. That's the thing. We want a fatback. What's a fatback? Well, a fatback is a fat, heavy plod. Whereas I was into crack. You know, that's my vocabulary. The fatback. Ah, I shudder to think of it.
But I know, I mean, obviously you and Sting and getting on with each other is famous. You are not getting on with each other. But it was actually...
By the way, we did 90% of the time. We had a deep emotional bond, but when we would get into the band room more and more, it was about the music, that he has a vision of music that is perfect in his mind, and for him there is only one artistic truth. And to depart from that causes him physical pain. I've seen it. Stuart, can't you just see the truth of what I'm saying?
And I'll try.
Yeah, and I recognize that there are many artistic truths. I can do this, I can do that. And I would look at the mirror every morning and say, today I'm going to make Sting happy. Anything he wants, I shall do it, no problem. And by the way, I think he looked in the mirror, today I will let Stuart be Stuart. And it didn't last.
But what I think is it's their yin and yang that made it so exciting as a band. You know, if you don't mind me saying, you're a super tiggerish person, right? And Sting is very, you know, thoughtful.
Well,
and
he is, as I like to say, he is quiet and deep. I am noisy and shallow.
Right. but it was that difference that came together that made it so whole and complete. And, you know, Andy obviously just sort of orchestrated
it. Andy made it sophisticated.
I can't think of another band that had such an important personality on the drums. Other than Keith.
Well, Rat Scabies.
Or Bonham. You know, it's very rare, isn't it, normally? Yeah. And especially in a three-piece. But I also think, this might be something to chuck out there, is we all know how important a rhythm section is in a group.
But keep telling them.
But when one of, but when one of that rhythm section is the singer and the songwriter as well, there seems to be that be, that makes something much more connected with the rhythm section, doesn't it? Is
that, that's a good theory, actually, because
they're not just supporting the guy who's coming with his song.
Yeah,
they are the song.
He is the song, and I think that actually is a good factor. It's true of when. Of any three piece, I think what you're saying is true. If it was the guitarist was also the singer and songwriter, I think it would be the same dynamic.
Maybe it was also
when the singer is a separate guy, it sort of separates it from the music, and it's the music becomes more background.
Yep.
But when the singer is the music, there's more. The music goes to the front.
That's probably the only time as well where the bass player doesn't get told what to play. Or is allowed to play whatever he wants, but is if he's the guy.
If he's the guy writing the... Yeah, by the way, Stingo did have to learn those bass parts. They're really tough. Singing and playing
bass is so counterintuitive.
Whoa. Yeah, particularly if the bass lines are back to front and upside down.
Even if you're playing the same time as the guitar. I've had this loads of songs. I can pick up a guitar and play a song. It's the easiest thing in the world. Yeah. If I have to do it on the bass, I have to engage a whole other bit.
Yeah, and you really have
to... I know, you're having a go at me here.
I'm not having a go at you.
Your job is easy. We should talk about the orchestra.
That's exactly what I want to do next, and which starts with...
Deranged. I love that title.
Which starts with a great annoyance on my part, which is that I had to turn it down.
Really?
Turn down some gigs with you.
That's right. You were going to do it.
And I was going to do it. And
I could never afford you in a million years, you know.
Yes, you can. But
in fact, all my musicians are people that I can't afford. And like my Armand Sabaleka, who plays bass for me in America. Rusty Anderson, who's Paul McCartney's guitarist.
Yeah, he's a great
guitarist. I can't afford either of those guys. But we're chuckle buddies. And we ride on the bike path every Sunday morning together. And breakfast is on me for life.
Where are you? Do you cycle? What do you
say? Along the bike path. It's all flat along the Santa Monica Beach in Venice.
I don't like this implication that I didn't do it because you couldn't afford me. I didn't do it.
No, that's a brag. That's me bragging.
No, the only reason I didn't do it was because it would have been involved literally the day after when we finished the Source of Full of Secrets tour in Europe, right? Which was 90 shows in 60 days in 29 countries, flying straight to Germany, doing one day's rehearsal, and then doing a gig.
I would have liked to have seen you up there with Stuart playing. You've never played together?
No, I don't think so.
I think at some Hollywood party years ago.
That kind of rings a bell, yeah.
Yeah, and I think there might have been...
Ringo was there, and one of those fancy La Frenée parties.
Exactly. Obviously a La Frenée related.
So Ringo didn't get up. You did.
No, Ringo did get up. I played with both of them.
I can't remember whether I got up first or
Ringo. You're such a
tart. Oh, Ringo. It's like he's just got a vibe.
Do you know
he doesn't go brrrr. No.
It's like you.
Well, there's a great video
the
of you playing his kit. Isn't there? Wasn't it his kit? No. I mean, there's a video of you playing his kit.
Oh, that's
Ringo's
right. There was
kit.
Some documentary about Ringo, and they talked to every drummer under the sun, and they had his kit there.
But what's the kit? Yeah, what's the kit like? Did you go? Oh my God, it's Ringo. Or was it just the way he hits it?
It was just a regular old drum set.
Yeah.
But it looked. It was that gray pearl. But I once got a call from George Martin, who was playing the Hollywood Bowl. With the LA Symphony. And he, for some reason, called me to play drums. Weird choice, but yes, sir. And so
who can do Ringo?
Yeah, really. And so a couple things. First of all, he sent me the playlist, and I made a little playlist, and I sit down to play drums. And I knew every song without even thinking about it. I just knew the song. Well, I wasn't even particularly a Beatles fan, but it just goes into the musical memory. It's a very strange thing. And the other thing was that I decided, well, if it's going to be Ringo, I'll play a Ringo. One tom-tom here, one tom-tom there, ride cymbal, crash cymbal, hi-hat.
If
you can be a Beatle with that, I should be able to, you know.
Yeah.
And I discovered something amazing is how much fun it is to play drums without all these drums in the way, without, right here, doom, bang. And it was a kind of an epiphany, actually.
But he was never, ever simple with Ringo. Everything follows the song, right? You can actually take all the music away and just listen to the drum part, and you'll probably guess what it is.
Sometimes, because he used his tom-toms
a lot. Come Together should have... There should be publishing for that drum part.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's get back onto your deranged Police, because you've got this orchestrated album of Police songs, and you went back to the multi-tracks, I guess. There, two questions, you know. I mean, did you discover stuff that you didn't know was there? And
yes,
did you discover, or were you reminded of emotional stuff that maybe
affected
your arrangements?
No, the emotional stuff we've resolved.
Okay, but what I think I mean by that is, it's partly in his songs, right? That his songs, and I think it comes out in your orchestration, they have a dark side that was just barely toyed with on the original singles, but you've kind of mined a bit.
Well, the orchestra has a wider vocabulary, even than Andy Summers, who has, I'm sure he's got 12 fingers, that guy. And the only way we can replace Andy Summers is with a big-ass orchestra. And so that darkness is there in the orchestration, but there's also the brightness too, and the two go together kind of well, I think.
But the point that Gary, not the point that Gary was making, but there's a thing you hit on, which I think you mentioned, which is that when you went back, you did find loads of stuff that never,
yes,
which you've now brought out in the orchestra.
Well, they were all improvised because it came from the film score of a movie that I made about the Police with my Super 8 footage.
Yeah, fantastic.
And to
great fun.
When it actually got picked up by Sundance and had a life and became a real movie, I had to do a score. And as a professional film composer, it had to do what a score has. I don't care if it's the Police. I don't care if it's the songs that put me on the map. It needs to take a left here. And so I got out the scalpel. And I also, and once the scalpel was out, hey, this is fun. If those guys had only listened to me, we could have been nobody. So the other thing was that I figured it should be Police music, but not the actual record. How about other versions of Police stuff, alternative? And so I went in and I found lots of stage improvisations that we did on stage, just stuff that, so they're Stingish and Andy-ish completely, but they're not on any record you've ever heard. So these derangements, although I've gone away from the original version, it comes back in the chorus. You'll recognize your favorite bits of the song, but there's this other stuff as well. But it's true, you know, there's a few things that I added of my own. But mainly, it's based on Sting and Andy and the synergy that we had. So it's all extremely Police-ish, but you've never heard it before.
And it gives you a chance to do the drums to the songs
the way
that
they should have been.
Because when you recorded, you told us last night, you know, when you recorded almost immediately you heard the song.
That's right.
And then, so you kind of discovered what the drum pattern should be later on.
That's right. Yes, yes, yes. And that's true. Well, you know, Sting had this great technique where he would not reveal his, on an as-needed basis. You know, there's a pregnant pause. We just played my song and everybody's staring at the floor. Okay, anyone else got? Yeah, okay, I've got another song. Of course, he always had another song. And it was always better than anything we'd been playing. And he would show Andy the chords. And as they're together and Andy's fiddling with the harmony and, you know, I kept hearing words such as F sharp minor, whatever that is, and all this musical.
Ninth.
Yeah. See, these guys are both musicians. They know this stuff. I just bang shit.
Come on.
And you got three girl singers on there. Three soul singers.
Yes, three girl singers on the mic. Three soul singers: Carmel, Helene, Amy Keys, and Ashley Tamara Davis. And they are three, technically session singers out of L.A., but I've exhorted them, pushed them, invited them, yelled at them. Step forward, steal the show, take the mic and own it and rock out, steal my thunder, go ahead. And they have all risen to the occasion. And we've played maybe 25 shows now across America and Europe and so on. And they've grown out of that, because to be a session singer takes much more skill than being a lead singer. Because
20 feet from stardom.
Yeah, the lead singer goes off and does their charismatic thing. The backing singers have to be on the money. Mm-hmm. So these girls have skills. But behind those skills, they have charisma and just power. And so they've really taken it and run with it. And I'm in love with those three women. And they turned me on to a whole genre that I missed as a kid, R&B. I missed it. It was all too straight for me. It was all too mainstream and the gold lamé suits. And I was into Jimi Hendrix. You know, maybe James Brown was the closest I ever got to R&B, proper R&B. But now, having discovered the Supremes, the Ronettes, you know, Vandellas, and these girl groups, oh, what an
incredible... Those drum groups.
Yeah, and the drums as well, from those rhythm sections. But that vocal group thing, okay, four tops too. But I'm obsessed with the girl groups now, and I'm discovering all those uses of three or four female voices, and that's right, where right. the arrangements for these came from. There's some harmonies that Sting came up with on the day, but I've taken them a little bit beyond.
Yeah, because that's the one thing with the Police, isn't it, where you were actually really stuck, which is in terms of vocal harmonies. You couldn't kind of...
Well, Sting tried to get us to sing. Andy yeah. complied and would actually sing. But I can't stand it.
Synchronicity's got a lot on from him.
It's all him. And on the records, it's all him. And he never sat at a piano.
But then you had BV's live, didn't you, at that point?
Then one tour, we had three women yeah. on the mic singing, and that I loved it. One tour we did, we had a brass section. Everyone hated that. Yeah. I loved it because I like working with brass, but management, everybody hated it because it's supposed to be three guys.
And how big is the orchestra on tour?
Oh, it varies, 48. I have two different sizes depending on the thing.
You can't get it all in one van, though.
No. Well, no, I don't travel with the orchestra.
Pick the orchestra up, go to rehearsal. It's all in your
diaries. No.
Then go to the NME.
yeah, exactly. There you go. But no, that's I've figured out the new business model. I don't hire 48 guys. They hire me. The Atlanta Symphony is playing a
revealing
show.
Revealing your on, tax break.
I was going to say, yeah, some of your accountant came
You know,
up
the
with.
Vancouver Symphony, Chicago Symphony, whatever. They're playing a show on Thursday night. They got their calendar, and we're doing Mozart, we're doing Shostakovich, we're doing Harry Potter movie night, we're doing living, you know, and
third. On themes.
So they hire me to come play my show with their orchestra.
So you go in, you have a sound check. And this is the first time you've heard that, those guys.
How y'all doing? We have a 2.5 hour rehearsal. Doors open at 7. You guys know, how long would it take for a rock band to get organized for a show? 6 weeks of shouting
and
negotiating.
Sound checking an orchestra individually.
Yeah.
Violin. Ing.
But whatever happens, the sound guy will start off with a bass drum, right? Boom.
Yeah.
Two, one, two.
Do the timpani.
but they, the front of house guy, the room, the theater, the orchestra, they play there every night. So they're cool for the sound. They got a sound check. Me and the guitar and bass and the ladies, but the orchestra's all set. So I just pull in. I feel like Chuck Berry. You know, when it's the Atlanta Symphony or Nashville or whatever, it's pukka. But sometimes I play Cedar Falls and I show up and it's the 28-piece version of the orchestra. And it ain't, you know, the Chicago Symphony. Right. And I feel like Chuck Berry pulling in, fire up the local high school band and count them in.
Brilliant. Right. Pickup orchestra.
Yeah.
Has Sting and Andy heard this?
I don't think so. I did send Sting the score, which is a huge book, that big, hardback, that thick, with all of the orchestral.
No tapes, just the score.
You spotted that right away. just so I can imagine him going cross-eyed. Both Andy and Sting both read music, but this is a whole different order of...
But you wrote this all yourself. You did it all yourself.
Yeah, I did all the arranging myself.
And when did you learn to write music?
20 years before The Masters, a hired gun film composer.
Exactly. And then you come it with what's F sharp minor.
You know what
Well,
I mean?
You know, but I orchestra is one of the main tools of film composing. And at first I would write it on a computer and then I'd hand it off to an orchestrator who'd come back and I'd go to the orchestra date and it doesn't sound like John Williams. I'd say, yeah, bam. Well, you've got to put a hairpin on there and you've got to articulate it. The line isn't da 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 da, it's da 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 da. You got to put that on the page.
Because we, as in bands, we're used to just telling people.
That, E.
You know, yeah, no, but just like,
riff
no,
and
here
E.
it's got to go, dang.
Yeah.
Exactly. And you see, well, the drummer talk, the drummer version of record, of music language is, da-da-da-ba, da-da-oo-oo, da-da-da-ba-chi-unk. And no, well, wait a minute, the ba-da-li-chi-unk, should that be ba-da-li-chi-unk or ba-da-li-chi-ba?
You're on tour with this, so people can go and see you for how long? How long are you on tour for?
Oh, it's not on tour because it's down to the schedule of these different orchestras. I have a show here.
You're on tour.
Well, I go
home.
No
one else is. This is your opportunity
to
sell
what you've
got.
Well, no, I play a show, I go home. Yeah. A week or two goes by, then I play another show over here because, it's hard enough routing a rock band, but routing to fit all the schedules of these orchestras who have their own season all planned. So it's sporadic.
And when are the diaries coming out?
Diaries coming out in October.
But you can And they're different versions.
There's all these fancy versions, and it's
you deliver them.
Yeah, I'll come. You know, the $500 version. You get the book. You get the disc. You get. I get. You know, I call you up and I talk dirty personally.
definitely you get, worth. You get an angry letter from Sting saying none of this is true. Sting's
Cloud's Revenge down the phone at you.
A little extra perks.
But the Cloud's basic Revenge book, is in there, right?
But the basic book is like 50 quid or something. What a normal book costs.
Version. Real primo version is that you come round to the house and you sell them a version out the back of your car.
That's right, yes, yes.
We have to go because his manager's outside and apparently you're going to Pebble Mill at one now.
Oh, okay.
That still exists. But, you know, I guess we've been told we're wrapping up. So.
Yeah, okay. Well, pity we didn't have much to talk about.
Yeah.
Well, thank you guys for listening to all my bullshit.
No, we love it. We love talking to you.
It's been fantastic.
And I'm so glad, by the way. I was with you guys when you guys were first starting.
Yeah, I'm going to say thank you.
Glad to be back when you've got some actual folks listening.
Thank you for that. And also, thank you for coming to the gig. Where was
it?
Oh,
it was LA. It was LA. That was a fantastic gig. Yeah, thank you.
A wonderful evening of just those songs with you guys at the front of the stage hamming it up.
Yeah,
great to see.
Well, we're hamming it up some more this year, aren't we?
Did you hear what he said?
Actually, we might be crossing his path as well because you're playing some Italian open air shows.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
In July.
Oh,
where?
Yeah, what? In July.
We'll
I don't know. Italy places.
Taormina.
You're playing Taormina. We played Taormina 3 years ago, which is
my favorite gig in the world.
Amazing.
It's fantastic. And we'll look up Jim Kerr, who lives there.
Yeah, absolutely. Has a hotel there.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, guys.
Good luck.
Cheers.
He's a quiet man, isn't he?
He's a very quiet man. I was really hoping that we'd be able to bring him out of his shell.
to take his light from under the bushel.
Well, exactly, because he hides it, doesn't he?
He does.
And I was hoping to do the kind of, you know, that we could be like Parkinson with Dustin Hoffman, that legendary thing where he just managed to extract.
Yeah. You know what I like about him? He's you know, there comes a stage when everyone has to accept that it's not the new material they want. He's the archivist of this great band and of that particular moment in time when they made some of the greatest records in the world, right?
No, absolutely. But I've got to say the thing that actually one thing didn't get to ask to say about was what's great about these diaries, and it'd be the same with them. It'd be the same with you, is that at the time to him it looks like this agonizingly slow process, like, you know, and even you said, you know, were you thinking of knocking on the head and all that. But it's actually moving really, really fast.
It is.
You know, but it doesn't seem like that.
We thank you for listening. And thanks to Ben Jones, our producer, Gimme Sugar. And
1 week, I'm going to get to do that.
I don't know why I do that. Why do I do that?
You always do that.
Because I always decide to do
that. Because you want to look like you're the nice one who cares about other
people. No, just because I'm just thinking the outro's finished, you know. And I'm getting on with things. You do it. Go on. See me.
No, you've done it now. No, next week.
I'm bloody letting you do it next week, I tell you. I'm going to be waiting there.
I'll forget, won't I?
Go on, then, you finish it off.
No, well, it's good night from me.
And it's good night from them.
Rock On Tours is produced by Gimme Sugar Productions for Warner Music Group UK.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.